This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, April 18th, 2021. Huge ratings this week. The data scientists at WrestleNomics headquarters have been working tirelessly on a new WrestleNomics O-meter measuring system to measure the normalcy, or lack thereof, of week-to-week ratings. That system was broken this week, in the first week in the post-war era of wrestling TV ratings. Much to everyone's relief, WWE finally put out its proxy statement. Nick Khan has been compensated enough money probably to fund a small army. That means we also got an update on WWE ownership. Plus, exciting new revelations from the world of correspondence between World Wrestling Entertainment and the Securities and Exchanges Commission. Just who are WWE's biggest customers? Whoever they are, we now know by year just how much they paid WWE. All that coming up, but first. And now joining us from WrestleNomics HQ 2, Chris Gullo, who is suffering from the second vaccine shot right now.
Yeah, I got the chills a little bit, but I'm powering through here for the great WrestleNomics listener audience. So.
Yes. You got the Pfizer vaccine, now your second dose. Just 3 weeks from now, you will be immune. You will have full immunity. You'll be 99% immune from COVID-19.
Until they say, hey, you got to get it again in 6 months.
Until it mutates.
Which I'm fully expecting, yeah.
Yes. Yes. I expected to have a new microphone by this time, but I do not have it. I bought a microphone, the Rode brand pod mic. From eBay, from a mysterious seller who had very few interactions or transactions in their parentheses. But I figured it would be fine because it was a good price and I'll take my chances. I never got it. And that user is now deleted. That user now does not exist on eBay. So I've had to order that microphone from Amazon. Hopefully I'll get a refund here from eBay or something.
But, do you happen to buy it through PayPal at all?
No, I use my credit card. But I think I'll be fine. Otherwise, there's going to be some problems for the WrestleNomics accounting department pretty soon. I've been working on Python. You know what Python is? We've discussed this before. I'm building Frankensteins out of Python script in most of my free time at the moment. I'm creating programs that will scrape Shubha's Daily, that will scrape Google Trends. That's mostly been established. But now I'm building programs that will automatically read the text, the top 150 text on the Shubha's Daily pages, and that will automatically open Shubha's Daily web pages in my browser. So look out. I have submitted my API application to Twitter. They sent an email back to me saying they need more information from me. So I don't know what other information they need from me beyond what I already gave them, but we'll see what happens. If I will be creating any Twitter bots in the near future, we'll see.
All right, so you're ready to kind of talk about the week after WrestleMania here. And it was a pretty eventful week, Brandon. Mm-hmm. We'll get right into it. Something we talked about last week, we were very intrigued on the ratings. How are the ratings going to turn out for the shows that were moving and just for Raw and SmackDown after WrestleMania? And we'll kind of start with AEW, which might be the darling of the week with their ratings increase. Why don't you get into a little bit of how, I believe, 1.2. million
yes,
total viewers.
The big story in ratings this week, Miz and Mrs. Wipeout, totally overshadowed by AEW's rating. As you said, 1.2 million viewers, the second highest AEW has ever done for Dynamite on TNT, just short of its debut, which also did 1.2 million viewers, but a little bit more than this one. Did a 0.44 in the demo rating of 18 to 49. That comes out to about 570,000 viewers in that key ad demo. That is not the highest, the second highest in the history of the show. That is only the highest since December 9th, which is that episode after Winter is Coming that did even better than Winter is Coming, that had sort of the advertised interview of Sting for the first time. But a really high rating, a lot better than it had been doing in the weeks leading up to this. To the final weeks of the Wednesday Night War were really NXT getting more and more competitive with AEW than it had been in the more recent months. So, but this did, I don't know what they did last week. They did something like 700 or 800,000 viewers total.
700, but, I believe.
And, but this episode in 1849 ranked number two on among cable originals. It beat two NBA games that it was going against on ESPN.
That's impressive.
Which I've heard Tony Khan is ecstatic about. It did not beat Challenge, of course, MTV, which ranked number one on cable. And it did not beat The Masked Singer on Fox, which did an enormous demo number of 1.22. But I was very surprised by this. I was sort of refreshing Showbiz Daily, of course, on Wednesday or Thursday afternoon. And I was just shocked when I saw this 1.2 million viewer number. I had to look a couple times to make sure I didn't make a mistake, because I do make mistakes sometimes here and like read the wrong number in the row.
Well, just say we knew there was going to be an increase. I was expecting a million. I'm sure maybe that's what you were expecting too.
I was expecting NXT to benefit more from this move than AEW. I expected AEW to benefit as well, but NXT to benefit more, because I sense, and there's sort of the numbers and the trends over the last year and a half bear this out, that people have chosen, wrestling fans have chosen AEW a little bit more than they have chosen NXT. So now not having to make that choice, that would benefit NXT more. But it didn't. AEW benefited a lot more, at least in 1 week. And we'll see what happens in the weeks to come. But when this number, in the minutes after this number was first realized, I brought this to the attention of someone in AEW who may or may not have previously hosted this podcast. And he did not believe me that was the real number. And, I said, oh, Showbuzz will have it in a moment. And they did. So that, and this is Nielsen. This is the number that anybody's going to have access to. Although if you're a Nielsen subscriber, you'll have access to a wider variety of demos and breakdowns and things of that nature. But, yeah, what do we attribute this to though? You had Mike Tyson. Is it WrestleMania 14 here all over again? Did Mike Tyson draw this number? I kind of doubt it. I'm sure he helped, but I don't think he's the lone factor. I've heard a lot of people say, hey, look, Chris Jericho did this interview on the WWE Network on WrestleMania weekend with Steve Austin, the Steve Austin podcast, whatever they call it, which some people have called an ad, a two-hour ad on the WWE Network for AEW. Maybe that's a factor, too. It was Mania week, so it's maybe sort of a general, it's the first episode following WrestleMania, so maybe there's a general increased interest in wrestling overall. But also, AEW, I don't know if this is reported elsewhere, but AEW did local advertising on USA the night before when NXT was on in some markets. So maybe that's a factor too.
Yeah.
As far as a demo, this is really on the high end, but not so high. So much on the high end as the total viewership was, but we'll see what happens. I guess the question is, you know, is how close is this number to where AEW now lives? I expect it will be lower this coming Wednesday when we get the number on Thursday. Will it be over a million though? I guess that's I remember saying this. I'm so proud of myself though. Well, I remember saying, you know, a million is a good over under to think about where AEW was going to perform in its debut episode. And I think a million is a good over under to think about where it's going to perform next week, as far as, are they going to maintain this audience of this size? I would expect about a million, maybe about a million, and maybe a bit lower in the demo, maybe a 0.40 or something like that is a good over under.
One of the factors that I think it is, and I know it's not the key demo, but the 50 and plus, I mean, looking at it, that increased for AEW. And I mean, you think these are probably WWE loyalists that now don't have a WWE program Wednesday nights. Oh, Big Show's over there. Oh, Chris Jericho's over there. I feel like that's kind of what gravitated them to over there. I'll check that out since there is no WWE program on this evening.
That's right. And did you know that the viewers over the age of 50 this week who watched Dynamite on TNT, this was the biggest P50 plus audience in the history of Dynamite. Bigger than the debut episode. Bigger than any P50 plus audience that NXT has had on the USA Network. As we may know, as you, you know, listeners may know, NXT beat AEW, I think, in every week except for one among viewers 50 or over. There are some weeks where we just don't have the P50 plus number because they didn't finish in the top 50 for 1849. But in those that we do, I think there's only one instance where AEW beat NXT in P50 plus. So this big total viewer number is totally carried by viewers over the age of 50. So we'll move on to NXT.
All right. So, and NXT first Tuesday night show in a permanent time slot there, and they saw an increase as well. Well, it took a nice increase, but Brandon, from what you're alluding to, you expected even more.
I would have to look. I mean, they still did a really good number compared to what they had done the last week. It's weird because, you know, as I said, NXT appeared to be gaining ground on AEW in the weeks leading up to the end of the war here, and they did something that was within the range of what they had done the week in those last 2 weeks of the war. They did a 0.22 in the demo. It's what they did the last 2 weeks. But they did do, I don't know that they even did a higher viewership number. I would have to look, but they did a 0.22 in the demo. That's the same as they did for the takeover. Now, granted, they did the takeover where they had some portion of viewers that we don't know watching on Peacock, because that takeover episode was on both Peacock and USA Network. But 2 weeks ago, they did a 0.21 in the demo. Again, they did a 0.22 this week. So almost the same. But then 3 weeks ago, they went all the way down to a 0.14. So what is that? That's like a third. That's a 33% increase over that. And then that 0.14 was more in the neighborhood of what they had been doing in the last few months of the Wednesday Night War. In the demo, so I really figured that these two programs would be really competitive. Would be more competitive now in terms of their numbers, not running head to head. But AEW beat NXT in all of the, I think there's 8 or 9 Showbiz demos. AEW was ahead solidly on all of them. By the way, Raw, we'll talk about Raw in a moment, but Raw was ahead of AEW. So now we've got, and this is nothing really new, but we've got, you know, these really different stratospheres where Raw and SmackDown live up here, SmackDown doing a little bit better. And we got Raw, you know, there, and then there's this AEW stratosphere, and now there's this near it, but right below it, the NXT stratosphere. And then, of course, very close to the ground, there's the Impact stratosphere. But that, yeah, that's where they are. And I think the question about NXT is a similar one to the question about AEW. Is this, how close is this to their normal rating going forward when they're not opposed on a Tuesday night? This more so than the AEW number where I say, you know, they did 1.2 million here. I think they... A good over under is 1 million. I think the number that they did here is a good over under for what they will do going forward, or what they will do this coming week. 800,000 viewers, 0.22 in the demo. If they do lower than that, it starts to get not concerning to the network and all that stuff, but sort of like, oh, I thought maybe they would do better.
Well, it's interesting because this total viewer count that they got was the average that AEW would get going against them head to head. And then this is the number that they got here on a Tuesday running unopposed. I mean, I expected it might even be a little more, but I mean, 805,000, I think, is pretty much what it, you know, it's a very good increase from, I mean, what they usually average, what, 6 to 650, I think.
Something like that. 650, 700 in the last couple months. And then moving on to Monday Night Raw, it's post-WrestleMania episode. Of course, at least in my opinion, Monday Night Raw is post WrestleMania is very interesting because of how the crowd is going to react. And although there were fans at WrestleMania, there were not fans who were back in the Thunderdome for Raw. Last year, the post Mania episode did a totally normal number relative to what it had been doing in the previous weeks. There was no pop. There was no post WrestleMania pop in the number. It was like -1 compared to the median the last 4 weeks last year. This year, something like a 16% increase compared to the last 4 weeks. This was the highest, This was the highest total audience since January 4th, since that Legends night with Hogan and whatnot. But this was the highest demo number, a 0.68 in the demo. Remember, for comparison, AEW did a 0.44, NXT did a 0.22. So this is like 3 times what NXT did. This is the highest demo audience, 1849 audience, since last year's post WrestleMania, which was a disappointing number, but it's declined since then to such an extent, because partly because that's the nature of TV viewership in general, with people watching TV less. But their highest demo number since last year's WrestleMania, they swept the top three slots in the 18-49 audience. They were only behind American Idol on ABC and The Voice on NBC. So, Vince, you got to do more singing, I think, if you really want to do even better. I think you need to become more of an entertainment show. And what people are not talking about, I probably don't talk enough about the reality programs and their viewership. Miz and Mrs. Had the lead in from Raw at 11 p.m., and they did 405,000 viewers. They did a 0.26 rating in the demo. What does that mean? That is the highest demo number that they've done since season one in 2019. So this is a really good number. They ranked number 12 on the night among cable originals. That demo number is also the highest. That rank is also the highest since 2019. So, but this was the, I guess this was the first, I don't watch Ms. and Mrs. I don't know if you do, Gullo.
I don't. I mean, I know it just came back. I think this is like a new season.
This, according to Wikipedia, this is still the same season. We're still on season two.
Oh, okay.
But this is the first new episode since December. We are still on season two, apparently. Despite
so the mid-season finales. That's what that
I
is.
I guess, yeah. We're still on season two, despite there being two multi-month hiatuses here.
To go back to Raw, how bad do you think the drop is next week? Because, I mean, obviously, traditionally, we see, the night after WrestleMania, and then, you know, I mean, it's not like they did anything like that, or they're like, hey, tune in next week for this, what's going to happen. Like, the surprises were not like, because I think they were trying to save that for SmackDown, at least what I thought. So I do expect to kind of go back to normal ratings for them next week.
Yeah, I expected to do a normal rating, somewhere in the 1.7 million viewers, somewhere in that neighborhood. Getting close to Dynamite in some respects, in some demos. You know, in December, where AEW had a really strong December because it had Winter Is Coming. It had that episode after Winter Is Coming that we mentioned that did really even better. It had the Brody Lee tribute episode that did a lot of viewers as well. In some demos, AEW in the same week was getting really close. And I think even on one occasion in 18-34, the younger half of the 18-39 did better than Raw in one week. So it would be really curious to see, and I'm sure it'll be a fun Twitter game to watch in what demos AEW comes the closest or maybe even edges out Raw in the weeks to come. Yeah. Do you remember, I don't know if we talked about this already since you've been doing this podcast with me here. Do you remember we did in 2019, in the weeks before, I think it was August, right? NXT had just been announced that it was going to go to the USA Network, and we like predicted what the
I do remember this.
Yes. And someone said that you're going to see younger viewers tune out of Raw and SmackDown, and you'll see more younger people watch AEW or NXT or something like that. But anyway, I that'll be really interesting to see. I think, you know, the Wednesday Night War, it gives us a lot of evidence to show this P50 plus audience. WWE has this bank of loyal viewers who are over the age of 50 who, at least in terms of a total viewership, it's going to be very difficult for AEW to ever overcome this, you know, this large audience that WWE has. It speaks to what the traditional thought is about why 18-49 is valuable and why P50 plus is not as valuable to an advertising business, because your 50 plus viewers tend to be more brand loyal. And, you know, apparently, at least when it comes to behavior with linear TV viewership, you got a lot of people who have probably been very familiar with the W brand for many years, decades. And AEW is a new thing that it may be harder to get them to try. So, but we'll see. Huge P50 plus audience this week. But, again, AEW doesn't care about P50 plus audience that much, because that's, you know, Turner wants them to get those 18-49 viewers, because that's where the ad money is.
So now we'll move on to SmackDown, which you would expect would have the maybe type of pop and circumstance that traditionally the night after Raw WrestleMania would have. But this being really the new flagship show, How did they do, Brandon?
So the first SmackDown since WrestleMania. We don't really have great numbers about this. We're just fast overnights because they are a network program. Showbiz Daily reports that. But 2 million looks like they did their usual 2 million. It looks like they're behind Shark Tank and Blue Bloods in the demo. My uncle.
Tom Selleck equals ratings.
He does, yes. My uncle works as like in production on Blue Bloods or something. I've never watched it, though. Yeah. but we do have clearer numbers about the WrestleMania SmackDown, which is a 2.25 million viewer number, a 0.61 in the demo, which is, I would say, slightly above average for them. Very slightly. I've got in the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet, which you can get access to at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. I have created a gauge tab, sort of like if you're driving a race car and you look down to see the gauges, you can see I've created a metric that tries to assess based on the latest episode numbers. You know, how out of the normal was this? How much was this a big overperformance or was this a big underperformance compared to the last 4 weeks? And this is a slightly above average number for SmackDown. This is the pre-WrestleMania SmackDown with the Andre the Giant Battle Royal and all that.
Which they tried to do almost as a SmackDown WrestleMania pre-show.
This was WrestleMania SmackDown, or was it SmackDown WrestleMania? In any event, looking forward to WrestleMania Backlash coming up.
I can't wait till we have WrestleMania SummerSlam and WrestleMania Survivor Series.
Exactly. I think, why not just... WrestleMania is this incredible brand that is recognized the world over. Why not just brand all of it WrestleMania?
Well, it's funny you should say that because I saw a tweet from MLJ, love Emil, and he's like, you know what? He goes, this is actually perfect because anybody you meet that's not a wrestling fan just thinks every event's WrestleMania. And he's right. Like, I remember being in an Uber in New Orleans, and the guy's like, oh yeah, man, yeah, we just had WrestleMania 2 weeks or 2 months ago, so it's good to have WrestleMania again. I'm like, no, you didn't. Like, you had Raw. Like,
I have a great podcast idea that you just sparked in my mind. Next year, if the world is normal and people are moving about in a somewhat normal way, someone should go to WrestleMania weekend and record a series of podcasts that is nothing but conversations with their Uber drivers.
It'd be good Patreon content.
Yeah, because you've been to a WrestleMania weekend, you've used Ubers, and it's always like this like kind of astonished Uber drivers, like, oh, they're happy because they get lots of business here, there's lots of demand for rides, and they're like, what is this all about? You know, it's great.
Yeah, they're almost the one guy goes, where are you going to? I'm like, oh, I'm going to a live podcast about wrestling. Yeah. He goes, why?
Yes. And it's always like, oh yeah, I used to watch that back in the day kind of guy, you know. Yeah.
King Kong Bundy and Hulk Hogan.
Yes. Impact Wrestling in its second Thursday did a very normal number for them, I think. 132,000 viewers, 0.04 in the demo. Not much granularity in the demo, but it does look like Impact is like doubling what they did in April 2020 in the demo.
I am intrigued to see, because they did announce that whoever wins the champion versus champion match, that person is going to be on that other person's program weekly. So if Omega does beat Swan,
it's probably going to happen, right?
I would imagine, boom. I'm interested to see if that does help them out a little bit. You know, people realize there's nothing else going on Thursday. Omega's there, and maybe eventually 200,000. We'll see.
It's happened a couple times. It definitely happened on, I think it's December 8th when he first appeared, Omega. This is not just an AEW Kenny Omega effect. I'm sure that's helping, but in the months before December, when he started to appear, on Impact, and other AEW personalities started to appear on Impact, they had been doing better in 1849. We're comparing this to April of 2020, where the demo numbers were really low, just maybe a function of the pandemic and there being no crowd. I don't even know, actually, like, what kind of programming were they putting out in April 2020 at that point? Were they doing no fans tapings, or did they have stuff in the can?
I think it was best of Impact stuff. Because I think right around that time is when they were redoing their app, too. So, with all the historical content. I'm not 100% sure. I'm trying to remember, because I know they went on a break for a while. I think they probably just showed best of. But they were like the first like to have empty arena. Like, boom, they were ready in Nashville. I don't think it was too much far after everything shut down.
Yeah, I should look into that. Somebody does the kind of research about ratings that I do should probably know that. So,
All right. So we're going to move on to it. It's here, Brandon. It's here. You've been waiting for it. You were misquoted about it in news articles. It's here. The WWE proxy statement. And once again, it's a proxy statement, not a power of attorney, as we saw released in certain news articles.
There was one sports, some sort of news aggregator that covers sports from some sort of international region. Brandon Tisinger was talking about how there was no power of attorney yet, and this could be very concerning to shareholders. I think Ringside News had been covering this as well, though, because I tweeted the clip of me talking about this. But anyway, the proxy statement finally did come out this week. I don't remember if it was Tuesday or Wednesday, but we have it. And a proxy statement is a document. It's a fairly long document that publicly traded companies put out every year. I think the intended purpose is to say, here's a bunch of information that shareholders want to know in advance of our annual shareholders meeting, which is coming up on May 27th. It sounds like it might be, we might be able to get access to the audio again. We'll see. we did last year. That's the first time I've ever heard audio of a WWE shareholders meeting, which is different. People may not know this, but it's different from an earnings report, which happens every quarter, which will be happening next week.
Big day for you.
We may have to do some sort of extra special audio. I don't know. We'll see. Or maybe I'll do it by myself. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. We get compensation information about the top officers, the top corporate officers in WWE. We get update on ownership, how many shares everybody owns. And what we've learned is not that surprising. We've got some information about this before because we know about his agreement that was already published. But Nick Khan has enough money to, I did look, he's not quite at the GDP of the smallest nations in the world, but not that far off either. 13, if you round up, $13.0 million is how much he made from this company in the 5 months in 2020 that he worked for it.
I mean, he's the highest paid member of the board, right? If you just look at compensation, yes.
I think
that doesn't include stocks and all that.
So the board and the board has independent people who don't actually work for the company, but they do get compensated by WWE. I think they are largely compensated or maybe exclusively compensated in shares. We'll get to the board in a moment. But Nick Khan's base salary, he made about $500,000 in his base salary this year. Of course, that's only he's only been working there since August. Same with Christina Salen, who's the new CFO. But if you, it was a prorated salary, of course, right? So if that was a 12-month period, it looks like he would have gotten an annual salary of $1.2 million. That's just his base salary, though. I've come to learn that when you're an officer in a billion-dollar company like this, a lot of your compensation does not just come from your base salary. But he got a $5 million sign-on bonus, which we knew. So this will be an exceptional year of compensation, I think, for him. Of course, part of the agreement is he's sort of under a five-year contract here to work for WWE for that amount of time. If he works for WWE for a less amount of time than 5 years, he has to pay that part depending on when he leaves. If he was terminated or decides to leave, he would have to pay part of his bonus back to WWE. So expect Nick Khan to be with this company for at least 5 years, I think is the moral of that story. He also got an enormous stock award, which is part of that sign-on agreement as well. So he got a $5 million cash bonus, it appears, and he got a $6 million award in stock units. He'll get another $9 million of stock units in September 2022. I didn't quite understand this when I read it, but this is somewhat based on his performance, which is also part of the proxy statement where they detail how stock-based compensation is determined. And that is determined by the independent members of the board of directors so that there is some sort of, in theory, fairness to this. Christina Salen, her annual salary appears to be in the neighborhood of $876,000 per year. So short of of Nick Khan's salary. Nick Khan has got a higher base salary than Triple H or Stephanie. He is short of the $1.4 million that Vince pays himself. None of this, by the way, includes dividends that any shareholder gets. When you're a shareholder like Vince McMahon, you have, I think, 28 million shares, something like that. They just declared their dividend. They declare a dividend every quarter, which pays out 12 cents per share. So Vince gets something like $3.5 million per quarter besides all this. So Vince makes, you know, well over $10 million every year just from his dividends. That's probably his biggest source of income. Stephanie has just short of 2 million shares as well. So she gets like something like $300,000 a quarter. She is the second largest individual person shareholder. There are a couple institutions that have more shares than she does. Stephanie and Paul Levesque, they have the same salary, and they have for at least the last 2 years. They have identical salaries down to the dollar. But Triple H usually makes a lot more because he's a wrestler and he has a bunch of big wrestling matches, including some in Saudi Arabia in the past and WrestleMania. Triple H staying the hell away from this pandemic, though, at least as far as having matches in it.
He did work one match.
Did he? In 2020?
No, 2021. Yeah. Yep. No, yeah.
You're talking about the Randy. I did think about this.
The Randy Orton match.
Yeah. I looked it up. Yeah. The Randy Orton match on Raw happened on January 11th, 2021, which I think was sort of an impromptu. Drew McIntyre's got COVID, so we got to do something here as a make good. So might not have happened otherwise, I guess is what I'm saying.
He could have paid himself a salary for that one time he had to color commentate SmackDown when the pandemic first happened.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Was it him and Phillips? Was him and, I almost wonder if Johnny LaQuasto, when it was brief time there, he did that. I can't remember who he was with on that. But
this is a great segue, though, because he makes some sort of inside joke about the speculation that he had been demoted. Remember this?
Yeah, I do remember that. And there was news stories everywhere.
Because the proxy statement had just come out and Brandon Thurston had tweeted about it and said, well, Paul Levesque's got a new title. He's now the executive vice president of global talent and strategy and development, as opposed to like the executive vice president of live events, talent and creative, which was his previous title. So everybody, Meltzer had written that he was demoted. I did not say that he was demoted. I disputed that because not because I think Triple H is awesome, but because I don't see that. And I said at the time, you know, if we see the proxy statement come out next year and there's somebody else being compensated more generously than he is, and we don't. Now, maybe his wrestler pay makes that less transparent. But in previous years, we've seen people like Kevin Dunn on here, but we don't. So I'm skeptical that there's anybody being compensated a base salary higher than him who is not listed here. So I don't – whether Vince – sees him as having failed to take a bigger bite out of AEW or not, I don't know. That's a different question. But it doesn't look like he's been promoted in any sort of, or been demoted in any sort of monetary sense. He's still got an identical salary to Stephanie. So.
So you saw new, you talked about maybe new names, surprising names. Well, we could talk about the board of directors that have added a couple names.
There's a few more things first.
Okay.
We've got compensation here for Frank Riddick. We won't get into that, but he was the interim CFO between George Berrios and Christina Salen. But we've got George Berrios still taking $1 million from this company.
That is right. I saw that severance. Yep. He's getting that 1 million severance, baby.
Which probably means that Michelle Wilson got very similar, if not exactly the same amount, because they were co-presidents, and I think their severance was identical. I think that was published. So I just thought that was not that surprising when you think about it, but amusing that even though he only worked 1 month for this company in 2020, he still got $1 million. So that's fun. Yeah. Shane McMahon. We always get disclosure about Shane McMahon's pay because he's a family member. He's not an executive. He owns no shares.
He's just a talent, technically.
He is just a performer, although he is working in some capacity as a producer in some cases. He was paid $820,000 in 2020 for his role as a performer. So he has been listed in previous years in terms of his ownership, even years after he left the company. But since then, so like since 2014, I don't I don't believe that he's owned any shares. I think he liquidated everything and probably used it in some sense in his other business projects. But shall we talk about the board of directors?
Yeah, there were some new board of directors that were listed, Brandon.
Yeah, so Nick Kahn. So who is on the board right now? Do you have any guesses about who's on the board right now, Gullo?
You know, obviously Vince McMahon, Nick Kahn would be
the chairman.
Chairman. Yes. I believe is Stephanie on the board?
She's a board member, yes.
And then there is like people on the board and some of the new people we talked about that technically like aren't really working for the company, but they're in helping make decisions, it seems like.
They are independent directors. So I think you are, I don't know if this is law or rule, but you have a number of independent directors who I think, you know, they have shares. They're given shares as at least part, if not all, of their compensation. And they are part of various committees. So I think they sort of make rules that are intended to be, intended to represent shareholders and not necessarily represent the interests of the executives who may otherwise have conflicts of interest. So, Triple H, Paul Levesque, is also a member of the board of directors. Okay. He's been a member of the board of directors for a few years now. Nick Kahn will be elected as a member of the board of directors in the next shareholders meeting. But Frank Riddick is still a member of the board of directors. He was before his time as interim CFO, and that's where he came from. Other names: Jeffrey Speed, who is a former executive for Six Flags; Lorraine Ong, who is a former executive for the Travel Channel. These people have been board members for a long time. Stuart Goldfarb, his name is missing. He has up to this point been a member of the board of directors. He is a co-founder and partner of Mellow 7 Tech Partners. I don't know what that is, but Manjit Singh has been a member of the board of directors for about a year or so. He's a former Sony executive. Alan M. Wexler has been a member of the board of directors for a few years. He is the senior vice president of innovation and growth at GM, the auto company. Steve Payman is a relatively new member of the board of directors. He's been very involved with Beyonce's world. I've speculated that maybe someday he's a candidate for being CEO of WWE someday, or interim CEO. Maybe that's Nick Kahn, though.
Okay.
We'll see. And Erica Nardini, the CEO of Barstool Sports, is another relatively new member of the board of directors. That is not included.
I find that very interesting.
Yes. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I know Barstool Sports has really gotten their hands into wrestling. I mean, they're the only platform that could literally have a wrestling podcast, a premiere, and it just beats most wrestling podcasts in the ratings with like a guy that no one really knew and this and that. Boom, they're right in the top five almost every week. So I know Barstool, obviously, they're looking to get their hands more into wrestling, which, I mean, it's more content. It's another audience. So
yeah. So she's helping make decisions, helping do whatever the board does. So these are people who don't work day to day with WWE, but it does include Vince and Stephanie and Paul and Nick Kahn. These are people who do work for WWE day to day. But anyway, there are two new members of the board of directors: Steve Coonan, who is the current CEO of the Atlanta Hawks, and he also is in charge of the State Farm Arena in Atlanta. He is the former president of Turner Entertainment Networks, where he oversaw TNT and TBS. And Chris Zellner pointed out to me that he was, I think he had some involvement in the final days of WCW, which I don't know anything about. Do you know?
I'd have to go look back at the Nitro book if he's listed at all. I mean, that does kind of sound familiar. It wasn't like a big player, but yeah, Nitro book, by the way, totally recommend it. Absolutely awesome book.
And Between the Sheets did a great Patreon podcast about the final weeks of WCW, which is always great history lessons. And Connor Schell will be another new member. These people have to be elected, but as I'll explain in a moment, it's basically a moot point. Connor Schell, who is the former executive vice president of content at ESPN until very recently. He is also the executive producer for the 30 for 30 series on ESPN, which a couple of years ago did a XFL episode.
Ric Flair episode as well, and they used a lot of WWE. And it's not technically 30 for 30, but same umbrella for The Last Dance. They WWE supplied them with WCW footage of Dennis Rodman.
Oh wow! Okay. Yeah.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, But with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it, and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You get a display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading, so you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, setting these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver. No drilling required. Keyless entry. No more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally, and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived, and really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys and reach in my pocket or, wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition. 1 second, door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is EUFY Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, EUFY Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
So these people will be up for election on May 27th. If you are a WE shareholder, you can vote at that time. However, one man controls 80% of the voting shares. So
it's the man that never sleeps.
Nick Khan? No.
No. No. Oh, I feel like he gets a little more sleep than Vince McMahon.
Probably. So we also, as part of the proxy statement, get an update on shareholders who own more than 5% of shares and any members of the board of directors. So Vince McMahon owns about 28 million shares, which means he owns about 38% of the shares, which is less than a majority. However, as we've talked about a number of times here on WrestleNomics, Vince McMahon, just like Mark Zuckerberg, is a founder, and their company went public with two classes of shares, Class A shares for the common folks and Class B shares for McMahon's. So Stephanie also owns Class B shares. Vince owns Class B shares. Linda holds a relatively small number of Class B shares. Shane used to have Class B shares before he cashed them out. And that means that Vince McMahon, for every one share that he has, his shares count 10 times as much in terms of voting. Still the same value if you were to sell his shares, but his shares count 10 times as much. Stephanie's do too. And that means that Vince controls 80% of the voting power.
Making sure he can never be pushed out. He's not having a Ted Turner happen.
Is that what happened to Ted Turner?
When the merger and everything and more people gained share control and all that, they pushed him out. Yeah.
So Vince would have to, I mean, it probably depends on who else owns what, but Vince would have to sell his current balance of shares down to a very small number for him to not have 50% or 51% of voting power. As usual, as always, the other large shareholders besides Stephanie, as I said, she owns about 3% of the stock, owns about 5% of the voting power. That Linda owns about 2% of the voting power, about 1% of the stock. Those are individuals. The largest institutional owner, as it has been the case for a number of years now, is Lindsdale Train Limited, which is a UK financial institution. And then BlackRock and Vanguard, which are mutual fund companies who WWE is probably one of like maybe hundreds of thousands of companies that they probably own.
Yeah. Vanguard is a very, very, very diverse portfolio.
Yeah.
I've seen that.
As well as Cadian Capital Management, which is a name that I always see here that I don't know that much about. And I think this is a relatively new one to me, Independent Franchise Partners. I think they are a UK firm as well. But of all the people that we just mentioned, those people own 78% of the stock. Then there's the rest of the world owns 27% of the stock. Again, almost completely made up of financial institutions. And I'm sure there's a lot of retail investors, some of whom may be listening right now. But it's in the grand scheme of things, it's such a small sliver.
Yeah, the WWE stockholders on Robinhood is very minute compared to everything else.
Does it show you what do you see there? Does it like show you how many people are investing?
Let me see here, because a friend of the show, Jonathan Ash, invests on Robin through Robinhood on WWE, and he was showing me before we even talked. I saw he goes, you really can't vote anybody out of the board here. Like it's pretty much it's happening. Let's see here. I wonder if you can see anything. Currently going at $56.49.
That's right.
A share.
That's right.
But I don't. That's not really giving me much. Yeah, it's. You know, it has the quarter earnings and all that, but doesn't give me much on there. They employ 900 people.
That's right. Yes.
So pretty basic image. I got caught in the Doji coin mania on Friday. So
Yeah.
Are you a Dogecoin owner?
Hey, I'm a Dogecoin owner, but now I'm down a little bit. I just bought like $100, but now it's worth $84. So, but I'm going to stay and I'm hoping it goes back up. I've been talking regularly with another friend of the show, Kevin Bennett, about it. And we think it's going to hit a dollar eventually.
Is Kevin Bennett into the Dogecoin?
Yes, he is. Yes.
Wow. Which is, an independent wrestler and rapper, producer, Kevin Bennett.
And Dogecoin investor.
Dogecoin Moogle. The remix. Anyway. That's all for the proxy, I think.
All right. And then you did have on here of some SEC correspondence for WWE.
Yes, that's my favorite topic in the world of correspondence. This actually had been out there for a number of months, but I just came across it the other day. And it totally upset my sleep cycle. Actually, what upset my sleep cycle is our taping, our post-WrestleMania recording, which had me up until like 2 in the morning editing. Let's never do that again. Let's never record that late again. So after the proxy statement came out, I was browsing through WWE's SEC filings for some reason, and I came across, oh yeah, there's every now and then you get this correspondence here where apparently they have to publish certain correspondence that they have with the Securities and Exchanges Commission. And one of my favorite wrestling related personalities is Mr. Lynn Schenk from the SEC, who corresponds with various people at WWE, including former senior vice president Mark Cowell, where he wrote to WWE that WWE has in their annual report they break down geographic information and break down some information about their overall revenues. They wrote that in the paragraph below one of these tables, they said, all right, we have two. This was their 2019 annual report. So not the most recent one, but the one before that. Something like over 100 pages of information in this. But one of the paragraphs reads, you know, there were two customers with revenues that individually in excess of 10% of total net revenues there. So they have two customers that are giving WWE more than 10% of their revenues. And that's all the information that they disclosed about that. They also mentioned that they were primarily getting those revenues in the media segment. WWE has three segments, the media segment, live event segment, and consumer product segment. And in June of last year, because June hasn't happened yet this year, June 17th, 2020, there was this correspondence. The original letter was written in January of 2019. Anyway, what they told WWE, hey, look, in this paragraph where you mentioned that you've got two customers that are contributing to more than 10% of your net revenues, you've got to tell us who those, well, they don't have to tell us who those people are, but you have to tell us how much revenue they're contributing. Not just this general, yeah, they're giving us more than 10%. So Mark Cowell, who at the time, I think he's now left WWE, but at the time was the senior vice president of something financial related, wrote to the SEC. Okay, we'll do this, and here's an example of how it will look in the future, based on, you know, here's an example of what it would have looked like in our annual report had we written it as you wanted us to. So they write, net revenues for these two customers that are giving us an excess of 10% of our total revenue in 2019 were approximately $207,000. It's actually, these are already in thousands, so this is really millions. Were approximately $207 million and $210 million, respectively. In 2018, were approximately $176 million and $110 million, respectively. And during the year 2017, we just had one customer that was giving us an excess of 10% of our revenue, and that customer gave us $155 million. So that is, I've not come across this information before. Saw this on like Wednesday night. I was up all night, like fascinated, doing spreadsheets. The next day, I thought I was going to maybe do a video about this. Maybe I still will. I have now made a 44-page PowerPoint about this.
Okay.
But anyway, who do you think these two customers are? Remember, we'll talk about 2020 in a moment. We're talking about the years of 2017, 2018, 2019, 2017, 2018. There's two customers that are giving them more than 10% of the revenues. 2017, there's only one. Who are these two customers, Chris Cullo?
So it goes till 2019, you said, right?
Yes. Don't think about 2020 yet. We will later.
So Fox would be one?
Not yet.
Not yet.
New deals kick in. New deals kicked in October 2019. So only a quarter of the year.
So NBC Universal is one of them. Mm-hmm. Ooh, the second one's tough.
Who gives WWE a lot of money?
Saudi Arabia.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So $110 million a year from this second largest customer. If you split that in half, you get $55 million and another $55 million. I had thought up to this point that each one of those events was about $50 million. Turns out they're about $55 million, according to this. And because those are, it's relatively simple compared to what NBC Universal is doing in terms of trying to figure out what goes where. So it's just two pieces of business, right? Two events per year. So $55 million. And it matches in 2018 and 2019. $110 million in both years, pretty clear. That's got to be Saudi Arabia. And WWE's biggest customer, pretty clearly, has got to be NBC Universal. So then we move on to the... So this all happened in 2020. 2020 ended. WWE wrote its 2020 annual report, which it put out in February, just a couple months ago. And it wrote in this same section of the annual report, net revenues for these two customers that paid us more than 10% of our total revenues were approximately $270 million and $183 million, respectively. Who do you think those two customers are for 2020?
So Fox would be one of them. And then would the second be NBC Universal?
Yeah. Which one do you think is bigger?
You would think Fox, but yet NBC Universal does have two shows.
Yes. So which one do you think is bigger?
I'm going to go NBC Universal. I'm going to go the wild card.
You have to be correct in that. It doesn't explicitly say, but the bigger one, I think, it has to be NBC Universal, and the other one, $183 million in 2020. There was only one Saudi Arabia show. Has to be Fox, and I think Fox would have been bigger even if there had been Saudi Arabia shows, because Saudi Arabia would still have only come to $110 million. That also tells us that there's probably no escalators in the Saudi contract, because it was the same from 18 and 19. So. From this, we learn that WWE receives about $55 million from the Saudi government for each event. I will try to get into this in some greater detail, but I think we might be able to deduce the rate of escalation for Fox, for the Fox deal. And we might be able to maybe get some insight on the value of at least the first NXT deal with NBC Universal to be on the USA Network. I think basically my takeaway, I've done a ton of math on this and I try to play out a lot of different scenarios where it largely centers around the question of how much. So NBC Universal, let's talk about what money is NBC Universal giving to WWE. We know in 2020 it was $270 million, but what are they paying for? They're paying for Raw, which we know over the 5 years between 2020 and 2024, it's really from Q4 2019 to Q4 2024. They're paying WWE an average over those 5 years of $265 million, according to the Hollywood Reporter, which has basically been all but confirmed by WWE itself. So there's Raw, just Raw. But then NBC Universal is also paying WWE for reality programming, such as The Miz and Mrs. and Total Bellas. Just those two at this point. There's no more Total Divas episodes being produced.
Total Divas is gone, yeah.
And then whatever's left out of that would probably go to NXT alone. So I think reality TV is worth about $20 to $30 million per year, around $1 million per episode. So if we can estimate how much WWE made just for Raw in 2020, and if we can estimate how much WWE made for reality programming in 2020, we subtract those values from 270 and we get the NXT number for 2020. It still depends on the rate of escalation for the Raw contract. It depends on whether there were any changes in the compensation for the reality programs, which we have no real facts about anyway. But I find the scenarios where NXT makes like $40 or $50 million a year to be less plausible than the scenarios in which it makes like maybe $20 million a year, or maybe even a little less than that. So I will try to maybe make a video or an article or something in the this week that explains this in some sort of digestible terms. But it looks like, to me, in my judgment and opinion, that NXT is at least its first deal. We have no idea whether the new deal, we can talk about more about that in a moment, though, whether the new deal was an increase, a decrease, or the same value. But we know AEW's worth $43.5 roughly $1 million a year. So this would put NXT at about half of that for what it's worth. And when it comes to, you know, your sort of your value per viewer, probably still well under Raw or SmackDown, but then again, they're lower on the chart in terms of how close they are to the top. I think the most popular, most watched programs are super valuable, almost like logarithmically more valuable than the programs below it, because people are, I think, in the economics work out, and like in theory, people are holding on to their cable subscriptions because of the programs that they watch most often, which sort of is obvious, right? So the programs that the fewer people watch are almost exponentially less valuable because they're not contributing to this, to retention of cable and satellite subscriptions or vmvpd subscriptions. So I think like the lower you are on the chart, you get way more valuable, not just in a linear sense more valuable, if that makes sense.
All right, so with that, I do have one more question for you before we wrap up, Brandon. And those of you who listen to WrestleNomics or follow the WrestleNomics Twitter or follow Brandon, you know that WWE has had a very, very, very good quarter one and are looking to have a very, very good quarter two. And the rumors, the rumblings, the reports were the 10 people that were released this week in the mass roster cuts on April 15th, which is the same date that happened last year. They were told it was due to budget cuts. What are your thoughts, Brandon?
The timing would tell you that there's something to that, because it was at the same time last year. So maybe there's some sort of recurring calendar issue where they're trying to meet a certain amount of, you know, they're trying to lower their expenses ahead of something. Obviously, WWE is more profitable than it's ever been, and we'll probably have another year this year where they're similarly profitable. They're more profitable today than they were in the Attitude Era, even if you adjust for inflation. But I could see, somebody telling talent relations, okay, we gotta cut our expenses under this benchmark here. And so John Laurinaitis or whomever sat down and said, okay, we gotta cut some people, or who can we most afford to get rid of? So that's what they did. I don't know. Samoa Joe was maybe, Samoa Joe is probably the biggest name here, and it was I would guess, because he's the biggest name here, was probably the most highly compensated among the ones who were cut. But yeah, it's probably just a matter of trying to get under a certain number. It's not as if, obviously, WWE is needs to cut costs to stay profitable. But yeah, you want to run a lean company. I think this is different than last year in terms of being able to make a moral judgment. Like last year, there was far more uncertainty, and last year it was not just talent that was cut. Right,
no, people, producers,
the media, the wrestling media world focuses on the wrestlers because those are the names that you'd recognize. Those are the personalities that you see on TV. But they cut and furloughed a ton of employees as well. So there was a lot of that happening, which I think it's one thing to cut talent who are already making six figures or a lot more. It's another thing to cut employees who are more like everyday people in the middle of a pandemic where there's vast uncertainty in a year where you're going to be your most profitable ever. I think it's different now than that. Right, we've been with this pandemic for about a year. The economy has not completely fallen apart, although there is still increased unemployment. But there's apparently no employees cut, although we're not that far removed from employees having their bonuses cut. But they did get some stock awards, which have now vested. Oh my God, what was that?
It's just one of my shelves. It's fine. Everything is fine.
It was the Jedi powers of Vince McMahon.
Yeah. Thank God. God damn it. Talking about it.
Don't tell me how to run my company.
Okay.
But yeah, so with that, Brandon, this looks like it wraps up another edition.
How are you feeling? Are you surviving?
I'm okay, but I'm not going to lie. I cannot wait to go lay on my couch. Okay. Like I said, I'm holding it up here. You know, I took some, Dayquil and ate an orange, a whole orange before the broadcast. And
so that's all we have for this week. Do you have anything new to plug for Skull?
Yeah. This Wednesday, you can check out RTI Pod on Twitter, Rediscovering Indies on Facebook and Instagram. Part two of XPW Deep Dive. And on this one, we're going to talk about a lot of things. You know, Rob Black ran for mayor of Los Angeles in 2001. We're going to talk about that. No, he did not. We're going to talk about that. We are actually going to talk about the free fall incident with New Jack and Vic Grimes. We're going to talk about them losing their TV deal with America One, which you have to do that is you have to take some skill to do that. But there's so much more to be covered. Here's an interesting thing I did not know, that WCW were still telling employees that they couldn't work certain promotions after they sold the company to WWE, and like WWE didn't pick up certain contracts. For example, we find out in this Conan, they told him he wasn't allowed to work at XPW, and if he did, it'd be a breach of contract and they would stop paying him. And same thing with Shane Douglas. Which Conan was still working Mexico and Puerto Rico and all that, but because it was the United States, they found out about it.
All right. This is WWE Q1 week coming up, covering the period of January 1st to March 31st. So just short of WrestleMania. No, and probably no WrestleMania information unless they want to throw something out there for some reason. But that's coming up. The earnings report is coming up on Thursday. Information will drop just after the market closes around 4:30 p.m. Eastern, and then there will be a conference call at 5 p.m. Eastern with all of our favorite superstars, including Vince McMahon, Nick Khan, Stephanie McMahon, and Christina Salen. That will be happening. I will be covering it in detail on Twitter, and maybe we'll do something here for patrons, something special, because that's a special day. I'm appearing with Post Wrestling also later this week. I'm getting my second vaccine dose later this week. And you can follow WrestleNomics at WrestleNomics. You can go to WrestleNomics.com and read things. And you can follow me at Brandon Thurston. I'm Brandon Thurston. And he's Chris Gullo. And we'll talk to you next time.